The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It would be dangerous to overuse, to misuse Section 4 because it would be like 24 and Homeland and these shows where they just don't like what he's doing. So you'd need one other element here. If you think that he's not just doing a bad job, but he's actually off his rocker in a dangerous way, not just that you think he's impaired, but that he's creating this existential threat, Section 4 gives us a little room to say, well, at a certain point, the crazier his order is, the more damaging it would be, the more urgent it is to stop him quicker than impeachment could do.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 26th, 2019. Brian Kalt is the professor of law at Michigan State University. Back in 2012, he wrote Constitutional Cliffhangers, a book about all of the gaps in and the potentially disruptive interpretations of the Constitution's text. Well, he's back again with a new book called Unable, The Law, Politics, and Limits of Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. The book is only about the 270 words in the fourth section of that amendment. In this conversation, I talk with him about the need for something better than what the original Constitution said about presidential incapacity. I talk with him about the drafting of the 25th Amendment and the discussions around its various provisions. We talk about how the media, TV shows, movies, and books often get important parts of the 25th Amendment wrong. We also talk about how an invocation of the 25th Amendment's fourth section would actually work. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 477, Brian Kalt on Presidential Inability. Brian, let's start with some of the reasons why we have a 25th Amendment, particularly Section 4, at all. Let's start with one person that most people probably haven't heard of, and then two that they have. Talk a little bit about Thomas Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, and John Kennedy, and how all three of those led us to the creation of Section 4 of the 25th Amendment having to do with presidential disability.
Sure. Well, Thomas Marshall was vice president under Woodrow Wilson, and he's probably mostly forgotten the history, probably most famous for saying what this country needs is a good 5-cent cigar. but not a politically powerful person. So when Woodrow Wilson suffered a debilitating stroke in 1919, there was a problem. The Constitution says when the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office that the vice president is supposed to step in. But the Constitution doesn't say who makes the decision. It doesn't provide a process. Very significantly, it doesn't make clear that if the president recovers, he gets his job back.
So that's all in the original Constitution, right, Brian? You're talking the language that the founders created and was ratified.
Yeah. So that's in the original version of Article 2, which at that point we'd had for 130 years. And so the country didn't have a president. For all of those reasons, Marshall was reluctant to step forward. And so Wilson remained president, even though he was totally incapacitated for a good long while. And Marshall's reluctance was one of the main factors that went into changing the Constitution in the 60s to prevent something like that from happening again. Eisenhower was next. Eisenhower saw this history. It was well known. People knew Wilson had been incapacitated. People knew about President Garfield, who was incapacitated when he was shot and lingered for months. And Eisenhower was the oldest person to have been elected at that point. He had some serious health problems. He had a heart attack. He had Crohn's disease. And he was also a military guy. He realized that having a clear chain of command was important, and we had entered the nuclear age. So the notion that there might not be anyone at the helm for crucial minutes in the middle of the Cold War was abhorrent to him.
And to be fair, that's something Thomas Marshall didn't have to worry about. Yes, there were some crucial post-World War I issues, the Treaty of Versailles trying to go through the Senate, but it wasn't as if Woodrow Wilson had his finger on the button and Thomas Marshall was leaving the country undefended by not acting.
Exactly. There were problems, there were inefficiencies, there were things that went wrong, but it wasn't the sort of existential threat that Eisenhower perceived. So after he had these health problems, he made an agreement with Vice President Nixon. He said, hey, if I ever can't do the job, instead of relying on this ambiguous constitutional provision, let's put some meat on those bones and let's have me say to you, I can't do it. I'm handing power over to you. And then if I say I'm better, then you hand power back. And here's where Section 4 came from. If I'm so incapacitated that I can't even say how incapacitated I am, then you, as vice president, I agree to let you step up and take power.
Right.
And I trust you, but then if I say that I'm better, then that means power comes back to me. That's the process. You say I'm not okay, you take power. I say I am okay, I get it back.
And given that we had no process up to that point to translate the Constitution's language into reality, that is, no mechanism by which the vice president could temporarily take over, this was a step forward, even though it had some issues, mostly being that it wasn't grounded in law, but that it was just an agreement between the president and the vice president. You think this was still a dramatic step forward?
It was, and it didn't contradict the Constitution in any way, but Eisenhower recognized that something more official than a letter agreement between the president and vice president was needed. And so he started the process. He asked his attorney general to put something together to propose an amendment to formalize this in the Constitution. And that's what got the ball rolling. And it was going along okay. Not clear that it would have gone through because there were a lot of different ideas about the best way to handle things. And not political opposition, just a diversity of opinion on structure. And then the Kennedy assassination happened. And that put this issue of presidential succession, presidential disability at the forefront of people's minds. And that really gave it the impetus that led to Congress passing it by two-thirds majorities in 1965.
So let's talk about that process and what we actually got to with the 25th Amendment, not the parts in it solely about vice presidential succession and even about Section 3, wherein the president can temporarily hand power to the vice president. But let's talk about Section 4 first. What is the actual process that Section 4 lays out for the president to be declared unable to perform the duties of the presidency?
So the declaration is done by the vice president and the majority of the cabinet. They send a letter to the president pro tem of the Senate, the speaker of the House, their written declaration that the president is, quote, unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they transmit it, the vice president takes temporary authority as acting president. It does specify that if Congress by legislation wants to change from having the cabinet be the one to do it to some other body that Congress provides, they can do that. But the vice president always needs to sign off on it. And Congress has never tried to substitute anyone for the cabinet. And it doesn't say cabinet. It says principal officers of the executive departments. But it was clear that what they meant there was the now 15 people that are the heads of the executive departments listed in in the U.S. Code, 5 U.S.C. 101. Not all of these other cabinet level people like the EPA director or the chief of staff, just those 15.
Well, let's break that down a little bit, because each of the elements you laid out sounds very clear when you state it declaratively, but there could be some nuance there that we want to tease through. So first, the vice president has to be involved. That is, there is no Section 4 mechanism without the vice president, no matter what the cabinet or the Congress does. Is that correct?
Yes. If there's no vice president, they cannot invoke Section 4. Mm-hmm. Although, if there were no vice president and they were in the process of getting a new one and it was not happening yet, there is sort of a reasoning by analogy idea. The Speaker of the House is next in line, could say, well, let's do this. It's not technically Section 4, but we need to do something, because the original constitutional provision is still there. The original constitutional provision talking about Congress setting up a line of succession, if there's no president, if there's no vice president, Speaker of the House is next in line under the current statute. So they could say, this isn't Section 4, but how else would we do it? We need to do something. But it wouldn't be Section 4. They debated, should we clutter it up with more language? They decided not to.
So that could be contested in one of the cases. And we will be getting to cases that are tough calls. But let's say it's the cleanest call possible. That is, the president is in a coma and is not waking up, and there is no immediate prospect by which he will wake up. In that case, you're saying, if there is no vice president due to a vacancy and the nomination and confirmation process has not gone forward, you think, reasoning by analogy, that all parties involved would agree that the next in line, the Speaker of the House, could agree with, in this case, a unanimous cabinet to say, yes, temporary power must be passed to someone else?
Ideally, yes. And I think in most situations, yes. Okay. There is the potential for problems if the speaker is of another party, if the vice presidential vacancy has been sort of prolonged because of political maneuvering, because there's a constitutional argument about the Speaker of the House being next in line, that that's constitutionally problematic. You could get things getting a little messy there, but I think that's, in most cases, it would just be pretty seamless.
Let's hit another part of this. According to Section 4, it's the vice president and, as you say, the majority of what we call the cabinet, but the principal officers of the principal executive departments. Now, that language was used instead of cabinet because cabinet is not in the Constitution. So if they would have used that, there would have been a discrepancy with the original language of the founders.
True, and there's also no set definition of what the cabinet is anyway. So even if even if they said that, it wouldn't have made it particularly clearer. But using that language, they were adverting to the opinion clause of all things in the original Constitution, which is sort of the only place the cabinet is mentioned, but it uses similar language about the principal officer in each of the executive departments. So they were trying to parallel that.
And we'll talk later about issues having to do with acting secretaries within the cabinet. But when you say the majority of the cabinet, this is not a majority of cabinet members present. That is, the language of Section 4 is clear that it is a majority of the principal officers itself.
Yes. So if there are 15 of them, you need eight. The reason that they required a majority, simple majority, not two-thirds, was in part because they wanted to have swift action, even if some people were incommunicado or there were some vacancies and things like that. Okay. They didn't want that to muck things up.
And then the hardest part, which is, what is an inability or a disability that would pertain here? There isn't a strict definition, and I think that's by design in Section 4, but certainly the debate over the amendment and the legislative history in crafting the amendment made clear that the inability was not just a coma. What else was discussed that you think falls within that wider definition of an inability of the president?
Well, they were thinking of hard cases as well as easy cases. With easy cases like a coma, there were some other easy cases like the president is incommunicado for some reason. That's harder to imagine now, but they thought if the president's captured or something like that, where he's not able to give orders, someone's got to do it.
And that does sound far-fetched, doesn't it? But we did have a case of that in the War of 1812. The British were within minutes of catching James Madison at the White House, and having a captured president would certainly bring up the issue of, is this person able to execute freely the office?
Yes, and that's going to be an easier call, although it still is really up to the vice president and the cabinet. We presume in a case like that that they wouldn't hesitate. But it's got to be the easy cases are those total inability, not unable to do the job in the sense of being incompetent or inept or something like that, mm-hmm. but really just not able, like there's no one at the helm. The Eisenhower paradigm for what we needed to avoid is really what's shining through there.
And we've talked about this before, Brian, but I want to share with everybody else our private conversations that one of your big reasons for writing the book Unable was to debunk myths and to make sure that what people are seeing and hearing in fiction does not inform their view so much that it overrides the reality. And one of those myths you just mentioned, which is that the 25th Amendment's Section 4 can be used to remove an unfit president who is not otherwise unable to do the job. Break down for us why, not only why that's a bad idea, but also how we know that the crafters of the amendment wanted that to be seen as a bad idea.
Well, they were really concerned, first of all, about building a consensus. This was something, again, that everyone could agree on, but they wanted to constrain the list of ways to get rid of a president. The president can lose re-election, the president could resign, the president could die, and then there's impeachment. And they didn't want something that would be used as an end run around impeachment. Mm-hmm. So they said, this is really just for those extreme cases where, you know, having a stroke is not an impeachable offense. So this really is a gap. But if someone's doing a really bad job, that's our problem. And we can either impeach or we can live with it until the next election. But they really wanted to protect the president. They wanted to make this only in those situations where it's the vice president and the cabinet, it's the president's own people. These aren't people who already wanted to get rid of him. These are members of his own team. Only then, only when they agree. So they used this vague wording of unable to discharge, but they really, by designating the decision makers, by giving, we haven't talked about it yet, but giving the process for the president to come back mm-hmm. and stacking the deck in his favor there, made it a very powerful tool for those rare situations, but a very weak one in any other one. So it can't be abused like we saw in 24 and Homeland and other shows like that.
Right. Definitely related to the myth that, and the popular conception in some circles, that any implementation of Section 4 is a coup d'etat. And you're pointing out that the crafters were very explicit about making it a hard process so that it could not be an easy coup d'etat.
Yeah, I mean, any mechanism can be abused. People say, oh, well, it's in the Constitution, so it can't be a coup. If you misuse it, it's a coup. Mm-hmm. But they designed it in a way where it would be extremely difficult to misuse in that way. If you've got the vice president, a majority of the cabinet, and then if the president contests it, super majorities in the House and mm-hmm. Senate all agreeing that the president's disabled, it's not a coup anymore. That's the overwhelming weight of the power structure of the government saying what needs to be done following constitutionally prescribed procedures. So it gives that legitimacy. And that was their main concern, continuity of power and legitimacy.
There's another misconception that I think you're keen on debunking here, which is, and I'm guilty of this myself with some of my own casual language, that Section 4 removes the president from office. I mean, I have used in my writings a wide definition of removal to include just undermining and to remove a president by means that are not formal removal. You point out that's a little bit dangerous because it leads to the impression that Section 4 makes the vice president the actual president, not the acting president or the acting chief executive, and the president can't come back. And that's just not true, right?
Right. That was the one of the whole points of Section 4 was this roadblock, that the notion that the president wouldn't be able to come back if he got better. They wanted to get rid of that. They wanted to make clear that it was temporary. So it does remove the president's powers, but he's still president. The vice president is acting president. There is no vacancy in the vice presidency that the vice president, acting president, could fill with an appointment. Mm-hmm. And the president can try to come back. He can contest it. And there's the whole process for him to come back. Not only is there a process for him to come back, he can keep trying. He can lose the vote, stay as out of power. The vice president stays as acting president. The president can try again the next day, every day if he wants, until his term expires. So this notion that the 25th Amendment, Section 4, gets invoked and the president's just gone and it's this swift disposition of him, it's just not true. It works quickly, but it's temporary and would not be as permanent as an impeachment and removal, for instance, would be.
So the key difference is that he is removed from power, that is, from having his hands on the wheel, but he is not removed from office.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, let's say that the Section 4 process goes as planned, and there is a temporary disability, or temporarily the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office. The vice president and a majority of the cabinet do transmit that to Congress, and the president then recovers. Ideally, the president says, I'm okay again, and he is able to take back those powers and duties of the office. However, it is not quite that simple, because you point out that it is a misunderstanding to say that the president retakes power immediately upon declaring he is again able. Why is that?
Well, there's a 4-day waiting period. So the framers of Section 4 were concerned. The whole reason to have Section 4 is the president might be unable or unwilling to admit that he's disabled. Mm-hmm. And so we presume the vice president and cabinet, they wouldn't do this lightly. So if the president's coming back and saying that he's fine, we want to make sure, and we don't want power ping-ponging back and forth. So there's a 4-day waiting period. The president sends his declaration to the president pro tem and the speaker. And then there's this 4-day period where the vice president stays as acting president. And if the 4 days expire and nothing happens, then the president takes power back. But during those 4 days, the vice president and cabinet can redeclare that they think he's unable. Then it gets kicked to Congress. Congress has to vote. And again, in the meantime, the vice president stays as acting president. So the president can't come back, retake power immediately, fire the cabinet, and prevent a new declaration. It's this sort of cooling off period, and they had to decide what were they more concerned about, a usurping vice president or an unable president who doesn't realize it, and they decided that the latter was a bigger concern, and so they set the president aside. But you know, people look at this and the wording could be better, and so they look at it, they miss that point. They think the president takes power back immediately. If the president tried to do that, it would be a pretty big disaster, two people claiming to be president at the same time. That's the whole point of this provision, is to make sure that it's clear who's in charge at any moment. And if you have that, then all hell would break loose.
And there's some real logic to their idea that we need to worry more about an unable president than we need to about an abusive vice president who's going to manipulate this, because the history of American vice presidents at a time when the presidents were clearly unable to perform, whether it's James Madison literally in bed for days, if not weeks, due to severe illness, whether it was Grover Cleveland having surgery in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean to avoid the press and the public and being incapacitated, Woodrow Wilson, you've already mentioned, James Garfield after the assassination. There are many cases where vice presidents could have and should have rightfully stepped up and said, we need somebody to run the country because the president literally cannot do it right now. And yet, what did we see? We saw case after case when vice presidents refused to take that step. So their idea that they needed to guard against that less than they needed to guard against the risk of having no president acting at all does make some sense, doesn't it?
It does, and requiring that the cabinet go along with it sort of mitigates that risk as well. I think it's interesting that so much of Section 4 was designed to overcome that innate vice presidential reluctance to step forward, but it couldn't completely cure that. And we saw that when President Reagan was shot, and he was under general anesthesia for hours. And they really should have invoked Section 4 then.
And you're referring to the assassination attempt in, March 30th, 1981?
Yeah. And Vice President Bush was capable. We needed someone to be in charge. Reagan was out of completely unconscious for several hours and was really out of commission for some time after that. But they were still reluctant, and Bush did not make any move to do it. The staff was against it. They wanted to project strength, because partly because it was the Cold War, partly because Reagan was so old, and they didn't want to feed the narrative of him being too old to be president. So even then, even with Section 4, there's still that vice presidential reluctance.
There's some real irony there, isn't there, Brian? Because in that case, if the motivation for not employing, for not invoking Section 4 was to project strength, instead what you had was the vice president flying back to Washington. Maybe the Soviet Union knew that he was having communications problems. Probably they didn't. But the vice president flying back, not in direct communication on a minute-by-minute basis. You had, people may remember the film of Al Haig running down the stairs and up the stairs out of breath, saying, "I'm in charge here constitutionally," which confused a whole lot of people, mostly himself. You had some advisors at the hospital not sure whether to bring out paperwork for Section 4 at all. You actually had the opposite of a projection of strength. You had a perception that they're not exactly sure what to do, whereas invoking Section 4 would have projected strength and continuity.
Exactly. And I think in retrospect, pretty much everyone involved at the time says, you know, if we had that one back, yeah, we should have invoked Section 4. And to their credit, they recognized that what had happened was not okay, that they needed people to be more up to speed about how Section 4 worked. They needed to have contingency plans in place. And they did. And every president since then has had those plans, so that in the moment, we wouldn't have that kind of mess like we had with Haig.
And that was only a couple of months into the presidency. And as I recall, the White House counsel Fred Fielding said he was still working on the paperwork, the binders that he would present to everyone in the White House and the cabinet on exactly how to follow emergency procedures in cases just like this.
Exactly. A young lawyer in the office named Cass Sunstein was the one Fielding had doing that, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And Fielding also wanted to have the papers ready, and the staff said, "No, get that out of here." They didn't want it even discussed. I think later on, there was more of a sense that this is not just about politics and stagecraft, but really there's some constitutional principles here we need to follow. And I think that would have gone better if it had been, God forbid, something else like that had happened 2-3 years later. They would have been on top of it, and the White House counsel's office would have been on top of it.
Sure. And there are some arguments that there are some truly tough calls when applying Section 4, and we'll be getting to those. This was not one of those tough calls. The president was clearly unable to exercise the powers and duties of the office. The excuse was, well, it was too early in the administration. We didn't have time to work out the relationships among the principals, much less all the paperwork. That really didn't apply a few years earlier when Section 4 was in effect. The amendment had been ratified and was the law of the land. When Richard Nixon was, at least temporarily at times, I would say unable because of, in some cases, use of alcohol, when Henry Kissinger would be taking actions that were rightfully those of the president because they weren't sure they would be able to wake the president. Is that a case for a Section 4 when the president, unlike a medical procedure with anesthesia, when he can self-declare that he is going to be unable, when the president, according to those around him, is temporarily unable to do something, would it have been right then for them to invoke Section 4 instead of merely taking on the powers and duties of the president and doing it themselves without that fig leaf?
Well, you've got to walk a careful balance there, because it might be the right thing to do if an emergency arises, you need the president to do something, and he can't. But if you don't have those sort of high stakes, if there are other ways to manage it, mm-hmm. you want to avoid a situation where you're invoking Section 4. What's the president's reaction going to be? He's going to, as soon as he sobers up, he's going to contest the action. He'll probably win, given that the vote in Congress has to be 2/3 in both houses. Mm-hmm. He'll probably win, and then he'll be mad. He'll start firing people. Maybe he'll drink less, but it'll be more harmful than helpful in a situation like that. So you've got to tread lightly if it's a minor, temporary sort of impairment like that.
So in the relatively easy cases we've had of Reagan, easy, of course, it didn't happen, but easy in that it should have happened, and perhaps in the Nixon case where more clearly it should not have happened, we have to look at a case in the middle. Because easy is the president is in a coma, and perhaps even easy is the president, an example I like to use, the president calls a press conference and announces he's fired his entire cabinet and is replacing them with barnyard animals, something that is so obviously a case of mental illness that there would be no question. Somewhere in the middle was a situation in March 1987 when Howard Baker comes in as the new White House chief of staff, and he's been told that Reagan is not paying attention as well as he used to. He seems to be distracted. He's not focusing. And some people are wondering whether there is mental decline that is inhibiting his ability to do the job. Walk through what Howard Baker did to quite consciously consider whether he should recommend to the vice president and cabinet an invocation of Section 4.
So Reagan was in a bad place. He was staying in the residence, just watching TV. He wasn't doing his job. They were signing his name to things that he hadn't even read. Baker, with this warning, sort of quietly has a couple of people position themselves around the table for that first cabinet meeting with the new team coming in, mm-hmm. the new chief of staff and some others. And they watched him from various angles and they checked his movements. And Reagan had no idea any of this was going on, but there were all of these new people there and there was this new energy. And that was the whole point of bringing in this new team. And he was stimulated by all of this, and he was on top of his game. And Baker said, well, I don't know what was going on before. I don't know the whole story, but right now, today, he was superb, was the word he used. And so that was the end of that. But if he hadn't been, if he had been sort of checked out a little bit or not as engaged, it's not like Baker at that point would have said, all right, well, we have to invoke Section 4. It would have began a process of sort of looking more closely, discussing it, maybe saying to Reagan, trying to have the hard conversation with Reagan himself, are you sure you're still up to this? It would have been a hard case. But as it turns out, he performed so splendidly that it went from a hard case to an easy case against invoking Section 4.
And that would be a difficult conversation to have with a president, but that's exactly the kind of conversation you would want responsible officials to have, to say, Mr. President, you know, we're concerned about this. We'd like to have you see certain specialists, or we'd like to talk to you about how you're feeling, so that the president himself can declare Section 3 and temporarily hand power over by choice, or perhaps even resign if it is a more permanent decline. That's not the use of Section 4 in itself, but the opportunity of Section 4 enables that kind of conversation in a well-functioning White House.
Yeah, it gives that kind of leverage, although it depends. I mean, people don't usually react well to being told they have to give up the keys to the car or to the White House. And so I think in a situation like that, it would probably behoove the chief of staff, if we're analogizing to Reagan, to talk to the president's family. If it's coming from the cabinet, if it's coming from people the president can fire, mm-hmm. then it's a little tricky. You don't want to set them off. But if it's coming from the president's family, then maybe that would work. And I think that the framers of Section 4 recognized that in these hard cases, it would have to be a tough conversation like that. It would have to involve the family, and it would have to be, again, a consensus inside the team. Not that critics of the president thought that he wasn't doing okay, but that the president's own family thought so.
So we haven't had a successful application of Section 4. So we're talking about something that is in the realm of theory because we just haven't had it used as such, which takes us to the world of fiction. And you've done something remarkable, which is you've looked at all of the movies, all of the TV shows, probably all or most of the books that have fictionalized a presidential situation that rightly or wrongly uses the Section 4 of the 25th Amendment as a plot device. You point out some of them did it fairly well, some not so well. Let's take those in order. The best movies, and this will be a spoiler warning for those of you who have not watched all of these or read these books, but we won't reveal the secrets of all of them. The best movies and TV shows you talk about are movies like Air Force One with Harrison Ford, Dave with Kevin Klein, and then House of Cards, where a lot of it happens off screen, but at least the fundamental is right. Pick one of those movies or the TV show, and explain just briefly what they got right, even in a fictional situation.
So I think Air Force One was the best. The president's riding home on Air Force One and terrorists hijack the plane. And so the cabinet and the vice president are faced with this tough call. The president is a prisoner of these terrorists and his family is being held hostage. So he's not really able to make the kind of decisions that he might need to make. He's sort of compromised. And the cabinet wants to invoke Section 4. The vice president doesn't want to. So the president is of no use to the terrorists if he doesn't have his presidential power. So she sort of hems and haws. And in the end, the president is Harrison Ford. So he single-handedly defeats all the terrorists and everything's fine. But they don't invoke Section 4. And I think it was a good twist on this historical theme of the reluctant vice president. The cabinet was right. The president had been compromised, right. And it's not clear whether the vice president made the right call, but it shows that these hard cases are hard, and they resisted. This is the best part, was they resisted the impulse that a lot of these fictional treatments have to take some license with the way Section 4 would actually work, mm-hmm. and just for dramatic purposes, because if it's never been invoked in real life, this is how people understand Section 4 is sure. How it was in this movie that millions of people saw. They got it right, and they recognize you can get it right. It's dramatic enough if you treat it the way it actually works, and they did.
And we have to give a shout-out here to the book that you said gets Section 4 better than any other fictional treatment you've seen, which was William Safire's novel from the late 1970s, Full Disclosure. So if any listeners are interested in the closest thing you'll get to a realistic Section 4 scenario, check out Full Disclosure. But it's more fun to turn to the worst. And we have to be honest here, we're fighting against an unfortunate reality. The amount of people who have examined the Howard Baker case from Reagan's second term or other applications of Section 4 that didn't happen, they're orders of magnitude less than the number of people who have watched West Wing or 24, two shows that you highlight as getting Section 4 particularly bad. What are some of those plot devices or the uses of Section 4 that are so horrendous, and what's the danger of that?
So the problem with the West Wing, and the West Wing was the first TV show to depict a Section 4 situation, is they acted as though Section 4 didn't exist. They said, oh, well, the president has to sign a letter, and he didn't sign the letter, and there's nothing we can do. So that was pretty bad. But then 24 did use Section 4 and recognized the dramatic potential, but used it against a president who was not under any definition unable. President David Palmer orders this military strike, but then he cancels it because Jack Bauer said, oh, no, this recording was fabricated. The strike shouldn't go forward. And the cabinet and the vice president, they think, oh, he's being indecisive. We need to act. And they try to invoke Section 4 on him. And that's, first of all, you could say, well, that's not how it's supposed to work, but it could happen like that. But here's the danger. This is miseducating the public into thinking, here's this mechanism where if we don't like what the president is doing, we can, I don't know, sort of like a vote of no confidence. We can just go in there and strip power from him, in this dramatic way. A few seasons later, had President Wayne Palmer, David Palmer's brother, is subject to Section 4, same thing. He was in complete possession of his faculties, and they said, oh, well, it doesn't matter. You called off the nuclear strike, so you're unable to perform your duty of defending the country. But then the other problem there was that they had this, I don't know, you wouldn't call it parliamentary, but this technicality. The cabinet was split 7-7, but someone had resigned earlier in the day and retracted her resignation and this and that. It was a bunch of baloney. And they, again, couldn't leave well enough alone. They had to play around with it, misinform people how it works so that people think that it's this easy way to displace the president and not this really difficult way. The deck is supposed to be stacked in the president's favor. And in these hard cases, the president can respond. They wouldn't invoke it because the president would eventually, in a couple of days, the president would have power back again. And so people just have this idea as a result of shows like that. And then more recently, Madam Secretary and Homeland and Designated Survivor, they all do this, and they all get the process wrong. They say that people other than the cabinet participate. They have presidents who are under no definition, unable, losing power, and then these technicalities about acting secretaries, things like that. It's really unfortunate because if they cared to get it right, they could really have done a great service in helping people understand this really interesting constitutional provision.
And there is inherent drama in Section 4 without getting it wrong. That is, it could both meet the purposes of entertainment while also not miseducating people.
Yeah, and Madam Secretary, I think they tried really hard to get it right, but they really muddled some things. And so someone could watch that and say, oh, well, this isn't a sensationalized way. There, the president really, he had a brain tumor. This is something where maybe we would use Section 4. But they got all the details wrong, and in a way that would confuse people if this actually ever happened, and they would think, oh, the cabinet can just do this or just do that, and they can't.
Some real missed opportunities. Now, there are some aspects of it that you have noted are legitimately troublesome or open to some debate, even though you come down on one side or the other. Listeners may not know, one of your pastimes on Twitter is knocking down conspiracy theories about Section 4 at Prof. Brian Cult. And one of those has to do with the issue of acting secretaries. The idea that's out there that if the president chooses to fire his cabinet secretaries, that either he can put in replacement people who would vote in his favor if it ever came to a Section 4 vote with the vice president, or that those people would be unable to take part in the vote. Where do you come down on the acting secretaries issue, and what's your foundation for that?
Well, the first problem here is I think that the whole interest in it, and I go through, I'd like to say it's a social experiment to see how people respond to being corrected on Twitter, but really I'm just being peevish. There's this widespread belief that most or all of the cabinet is acting secretaries, when in fact, as we speak here today, there's precisely one acting secretary out of the 15 who would vote. So it's not even an issue. The notion that they're all acting and they can't vote on Section 4 and that's why he did it, it's just wrong. There's one out of the 15. So you need 8 out of 15. If actings can't participate, then they're not in the denominator either. And so you have 14 and you need 8 out of 14. It doesn't make it impossible to invoke Section 4. It just changes the numbers around a little bit. But even if they couldn't vote, unless there's no one in the cabinet, you just need a majority of who's left. And then the idea that in an easy case, it would be an issue. It would only be an issue if the vote was one way if you count the actings and a different result if you don't count the actings.
Right.
If the vote turns on whether they can participate or not. But in an easy case, the president's in a coma.
It's unanimous.
It's going to be unanimous.
Right.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter. And then in a hard case, if it's a hard case, even if you don't have acting secretaries, if it's a hard case, they're not going to want to do it unless they're close to unanimous anyway. Because if they go to Congress, if the president challenges it and it goes to Congress and they need 2/3, if the cabinet can't even agree on it, then there's no hope that the president's going to lose that vote. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have these hard cases maybe, but it's going to need to be nearly unanimous anyway. And if it's nearly unanimous, again, it probably won't turn on whether the actings participate or not.
Sure.
And then the last thing is, the president probably would want the acting secretaries to participate, mm-hmm. Because they're easier for him to just sort of put in his own people. But the notion that it's sort of up in the air, that's true. It is ambiguous in the legislative history. But I think if you look at the text, you look at the structure, you look at the legislative history on the whole, I think the better argument is that acting secretaries do get to participate. An acting secretary, if it's supposed to be the principal officers of the executive department. If you're running the department, whether you're the secretary or an acting secretary, you are the principal officer of the agency. You have all of the powers of a regular secretary. Mm-hmm. And under the Federal Vacancy Reform Act, chances are you have been confirmed by the Senate for, you know, the deputy secretary position. For some, so you're not, they say, oh, well, you're not confirmed by the Senate. You probably were confirmed by the Senate for whatever position let you become the acting secretary. So I think there's some conspiracy theory out there really took root, and I try to fight it back. I don't know, though. It's hard to correct everyone who's wrong on Twitter.
I think that's what happens when you're in that middle zone. You have the three reasons to remove a president, to use the term the way I do, casually and loose. One is they're unpopular. The things they're doing just aren't capturing the majority of Americans. And it seems like the best thing to do is to wait for the next election. Or perhaps they're unfit for office via treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. They have proven themselves dangerous to the body politic, in which case impeachment is the remedy. And then you've got that they are actually unable to do the job, or they have some kind of a disability. As George Conway has argued in The Atlantic recently, just looking at open factors, he assesses the president is in that category because of his narcissistic personality disorder. But what happens when you're close to each one of those, but you're not over the threshold? You're in that middle zone, and then people start arguing over technicalities such as acting secretaries and what exactly is the definition of disabled. And you lead to a lot of those tough calls that you've also explored, everything from communication issues to defining that disability. Let's take the latter first. Let's say that there is a case, a hypothetical, of a president who's beginning to suffer from dementia, and the condition gets more and more attention over time. It seems progressive. But in fact, he or she looks the American people in the eye and says, I just need a little more time and a little more help than I used to, but I'm fundamentally okay. This would be a very tough call, especially in a time of international crisis, for a vice president and a cabinet to make, wouldn't it?
I think it absolutely would be, because there's a point at which dementia generally only goes in one direction. There's a point at which it would be advanced enough that Section 4 could and should be used. But there's going to be a lot of impairment before you get to that point. You can still be pretty impaired. The country could be suffering. And I think Section 4 is there as a backstop, as a fail-safe. What we would hope would happen is that there would be people around the president who could talk that tough talk and have that mm-hmm. conversation. And if they can't, then yeah, it would have to probably be pretty far gone before Section 4 would work. And you wouldn't, if you're the cabinet, you wouldn't want to try. You come at the king, you can't miss. And so it doesn't, and people say, well, but that's what Section 4 is for. It's not really what Section 4 is for. Section 4 gives us a tool, but it doesn't work very well in this sort of tough case. And just right. because it's there doesn't mean it would work. George Conway in the Atlantic piece recognized that after this long litany of mental illnesses that he diagnosed the president with, said the remedy is impeachment because Section 4 just doesn't work well in these situations.
Right.
And so he saw that. But you can also look around and say, well, it doesn't look like this impeachment is actually going forward that quickly. So what else have we got? And I think at the end of the day, that's the argument. You look at Section 4, you can talk about acting secretaries and inability and unable and all that. But at the end of the day, there are people who just say, but we've got to do something. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's not a winning argument in the procedures that Section 4 sets up. It's an understandable reaction, but it's not going to work.
Perhaps the most realistic scenario over a long enough time span of the presidency is a president going incommunicado. And you can imagine a scenario in which the communications go out with the president somewhere, perhaps in a time of crisis, but even not. If the communications go out for 10 minutes and the Secret Service is telling the vice president, because this is what they would do, telling the vice president with confidence, don't worry, sir, we'll have communications back within a matter of minutes. Everything's going to be okay. We have backup systems. It's hard to imagine a vice president invoking the 25th Amendment's fourth section based on the president out of communication for a matter of minutes. And yet go to the opposite extreme. If you have not seen, heard from, and have no way of communicating with the president for days on end, it's hard to imagine the vice president not invoking Section 4. What about in between the two, as the days get to hours or the hours turn to a day? How do you break that down? And number one, what guidance does Section 4 and the legislative history give us? Number two, where do you think in that generic scenario that the vice president and the cabinet would come down?
Well, Section 4 really doesn't give us much guidance. Here, too, they kept it vague and said, we won't tell you what the standard is, but we will tell you who the decision makers are, and we'll just trust them to make the right call. And I think they would make that call by balancing. There would be this sliding scale. How long has he been out of communication? How long do we think it'll be? And then what's happening right now? Is there anything that needs his attention? In the book, I talk about a situation where the president loses communication with the White House. He's overseas, and it's in a way where it looks like, for all we know, we're at war, right? If the terrorist attack destroyed a city where the president was, we need an immediate response. And so in that situation, you could expect them to not wait all that long at all. They would wait a little bit because they wouldn't want to be too hasty, but you know, an hour or two in the middle of a situation where you need a commander in chief, that would be enough. If things are going a little slower, I think it could be. I don't know. I can't imagine it going much more than a day, really. Mm-hmm. If you don't know where the president is, worst case scenario is the Section 4 is invoked, and the president. I'm sure it's right, like right after you buy something, that's when you find the one that you lost. As soon as they invoked it, then we forgot to reboot the router, and then, oh, there's the president. Mm-hmm. If that happened, you have this 4-day waiting period, but I think there's a pretty good argument that in a situation like that, the vice president and cabinet could say, we're not going to wait 4 days. We will declare right now that we're not going to reinvoke Section 4, and so with their acquiescence, the president could take power back sooner. And I think if that were established as something that they could do, then I think they wouldn't wait as long to invoke it in the first place because the stakes would be lower.
Let's hit one more hypothetical before we close out with some possible remedies to the very few issues remaining with Section 4. And that last one is probably the most disturbing, and it's one in which Section 4 would be used contrary to its purpose. But as you point out, it is the one tool which is effective for the scenario in which an instant effect is needed. That is, the President of the United States, perhaps without proper national security justification, may be related to mental illness, but perhaps just personality, on a whim decides, I am going to send out hundreds of nuclear missiles and obliterate a country just because they called me a name or something like that. You point out this is not what Section 4 is intended for. Section 4 is intended for true inability. However, you have seemed to have a little bit of sympathy for the fact that a vice president and a cabinet who are unified ethically, that even though this corrupts the system, this is not the way it's supposed to be done, if it saves literally tens of millions of lives, that there could be a justification for doing so in the short term. Talk through that a little bit.
So it's tough to make that argument. I see a parallel. I just want to start with an analogy to impeachment. Mm-hmm. everyone who I've read, all the scholars who've looked at high crimes and misdemeanors agree that it's supposed to be for public misconduct. So private misconduct doesn't count. So the president robs a liquor store and murders two employees. Would the president get impeached for that? Well, that's not public misconduct. But of course he would get impeached for that. Mm-hmm. There's always that sort of course they would exception to all of these things. It would be dangerous to overuse, to misuse Section 4 because it would be like 24 and Homeland and these shows where they just don't like what he's doing. So you'd need one other element here, which is that the president, it's not that he's unable, right? The problem is he's too able. He's ordering this nuclear strike. But if you think that he's not just doing a bad job, but he's actually off his rocker in a dangerous way, not just that you think he's impaired, but that he's creating this existential threat, nuking a country, tens of millions of people, I think Section 4 gives us a little room to say, well, at a certain point, the crazier his order is, the more damaging it would be, the more urgent it is to stop him quicker than impeachment could do, we should do something. Not because this is a really bad order, but because it's a really bad order and there's a sense that there's something going on, that he's severely impaired. So it's, again, that sliding scale. Impairment by itself isn't supposed to be enough. Impairment plus a clear and present catastrophic danger, that would be enough, at least to sort of hit the pause button. And if necessary, Congress can impeach in the meantime. But Section 4 is the only thing that gives that immediate effect.
Let's turn in closing to the few things you identify as gaps within Section 4 or things that could be clarified and then by whom. So we'll take the first one. Section 4 really doesn't help if the president and the vice president are appearing together at a campaign rally or are traveling together and some event occurs that renders both of them incapacitated. This is something that you say Congress could help to remedy. How could they do that?
Well, the problem with the double vacancy is, as we said before, Section 4 requires that there be a vice president. And so if the vice president is laid low by this whatever affected the president, then we have the Speaker of the House next in line. The Speaker of the House is not necessarily going to face any opposition to this. And if that happens, then we're okay. But Congress put the Speaker of the House next in line. The Succession Act of 1947, the current iteration, is what does that. The Constitution says Congress can legislate for any case in which both the president and vice president are out of commission. And their power to specify that line of succession, I would say, combined with the necessary and proper clause, mm-hmm. gives Congress an additional power to mandate a procedure legislatively. You don't need to amend the Constitution for this. Legislatively, that basically tracks Section 4, although they could do different procedures, too, if they wanted. But Congress can just legislate and fill in that void and reduce that uncertainty.
It becomes interesting to think about because you could imagine a scenario in which, using those different legislative and constitutional tools, the Congress decides, we will say that in the case where the vice president is disabled, that the Speaker of the House or another officer will act in place of the vice president for the purposes of Section 4. Then, of course, you have to go down another level to say, how will they determine the disability of the vice president, and it can keep going down and down and down for increasingly unlikely scenarios.
Increasingly unlikely, but consequential if they did happen. So mm-hmm. low probability, but high
Absolutely.
Stakes. I think mm-hmm. that's Congress isn't at its best in sort of coming up with hypothetical mm-hmm. problems to fix. But I think cases like this are where they should. And They've had some hearings about these things. Every once in a while, they'll come up with something. I think it's also a problem that anytime you talk about these things, people take it personally. So the president isn't going to probably want to sign legislation that makes it sound like presidents aren't always 100% in control of their faculties. It's sensitive. The line of succession, should probably be fixed, but that's always seen as an attack on the speaker. So it's politically pretty fraught, but I think that certainly the prudent thing to do is to think through these things. What might happen? What would the worst case scenarios be? And let's patch those up.
Finally, you point out there are some areas that simply by practice or by codifying something in writing, even if not legally binding, that the president and or the White House counsel could do just in case we find ourselves in one of these tough cases or litigating one of these issues that has to do with the different implementations of language that's not entirely clear having to do with Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. Tell us about a couple of those. What could the president or the White House counsel do now to help us in the event that a 25th Amendment Section 4 scenario goes down?
Well, I think number one, the first thing I would love for them to do is to make it 100% crystal clear to everyone that the president doesn't retake power immediately if he declares that he's able, that the 4-day wait is a real thing and that the vice president stays in power during that 4-day wait. There are presidential memos, White House counsel memos, that, like a bad law school exam, they talk about the, well, on this on the one hand, on the other hand, instead of saying clearly, no, this is what it is, and anyone who says the other thing is wrong, we need to be sure about that. The second thing they could do is make it clear who gets to vote, who's in the cabinet. I think the legislative history is perfectly clear. Any commentator who's looked at it says it's these 15 cabinet positions, not the cabinet rank ones. But again, we have White House memos that sort of say, well, there's some uncertainty here. There's not. There are errors, and there's certainty on the correct side, and they should specify it's just the 15 and the acting secretaries too. Now, that one really is ambiguous. That one could go either way. Do the actings get to vote? Do they not? The legislative history is a little muddy. I think that one answer is better than the other. But the point is, in a real situation, they would need to do something. The cabinet would need to know what they're supposed to do. And if the White House counsel, in saying, yes, there's some ambiguity on both sides, but here's what you should do in that situation, that would be better. Here's what we've determined you should do after thinking about it very carefully, instead of saying, well, who knows? They can provide that guidance so that in that moment where something happened to the president, all hell is breaking loose, we don't have to worry about interpreting the Constitution or mm-hmm. or finding, you know, where's my book to find yeah. page 181 to see what to do there. And then I think they can also help educate people, make part of their 25th Amendment Section 4 contingency plans public so that if these things happen, there's some, I don't know, legitimacy, publicity. They don't want to talk about national security things in there, but so some things might need to be classified. But by making these things clear and making clear not just to the people in the White House, but to the general public, so that if something goes wrong, people know and they say, hey, wait, that's not how it's supposed to happen. And they're basing it not on an episode of Homeland that they saw, but on the White House counsel's memo that was written during quieter times, then I think that would really help out too.
Brian, that makes eminent sense, especially if we're in a realm where we have a lot of transparency coming from the White House in terms of putting out documents to create that expectation of what would happen in these unlikely scenarios. I hope we get to a place where that kind of transparency is the norm, perhaps greater than it has been before, simply to assure people that if something does happen, we won't be in a crisis because no one knows what to do.
Well, keep our fingers crossed.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Brian Cult for coming on the show. Please share the podcast, rate the podcast, use your social media to talk about the podcast, whatever strikes you to help us spread the word. And please go to thelawfarestore.com to buy Lawfare merch. We have socks, we have pens, we have notebooks, we have shirts, we have hats, we have lanyards, we have challenge coins, we have lapel pins. We have a lot available for you to show your love for Lawfare and the podcast. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Jacob Schultz was our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.